This is John Paxson, News Director for Northwest Public Radio, inviting you to stay with us after the news for a special broadcast. We'll hear a Seattle Town Hall meeting from earlier this week where the presidents of Washington's universities talked money, what the continuing reductions in education funding are doing to students, communities, and the state itself. University of Washington President Michael Young.
Right now, the average decline in state support for public education, higher education in the United States, is 4%, but Washington is close to 50%.
The message from the six was this: crippling education will cripple the state. WSU's Elson Floyd.
If there are two sentences that I could ask you to communicate to all of your legislators, that is, invest in higher education because it's important to the future of the state of Washington.
Six presidents, after the news, which is next on Northwest Public Radio. This is John Paxson, Northwest Public Radio. Seattle's Town Hall this past week was the site of an unusual gathering of academic might, the six presidents of Washington's university system. They were brought together by the Seattle Times to discuss the continuing severe reductions in funding for higher education. They talked about the effect those reductions are having on the institutions and the communities they help support. And they looked ahead to what may be in store for the state if the downward trend continues. The view was, at times, grim. Seattle Times publisher Frank Blethyn opened the meeting with a description of what the universities are facing.
In November of 2008, the world that we all know changed forever. The collapse of our financial system brought the end of America's 60 years of world economic hegemony and ended the expectation that our economy would always expand and always be the world leader. Simultaneously, the collapse burst America's false wealth bubble of the 2000s, setting off the Great Recession and the painful financial reset. A reset process which has years to go before we reach the new normal of sustainable government budgets and a stable economy. Even when we reach that point, we're going to be in fierce competition with other states and other countries. In this changed world, Washington State's critical path to jobs and to prosperity is education. Our entire education system, from early learning through our baccalaureate universities, must be the state's paramount responsibility, priority, and duty. Inexplicably, instead of investing in prosperity and jobs, legislative leaders have responded to the Great Reset by cutting off our young people from the access to decent jobs, to good lives, right now and into the future. Consider this. If Olympia goes through with the governor's proposed new higher ed cuts, they will have slashed higher education by an astounding 50% over the last 4 years. Funding for our six universities has plummeted to the 1989 level. Our state's higher ed funding per student is one of the lowest in the nation, fifth from the bottom. We rank 48th in the nation from our citizens' participation in our four-year universities, third from the bottom. Even as we disinvest in higher ed, the jobs requiring a baccalaureate or associate degree are going unfulfilled because of the lack of qualified applicants. At the same time, jobs requiring only a high school education are swamped with multiple applicants. The unemployment rate for our citizens with only a high school education is 15.5%, while the unemployment rate for those with a college education is only 5.1%. By stopping the disinvestment in higher ed now, we can get off the downward spiral and begin to build jobs and economic prosperity for the future. Tonight, it is remarkable to have all six of our four-year presidents to speak at one time with one voice, a voice which understands how bleak our future is if we do not stop the disinvestment in higher ed and the loss of job creation. Kate Riley, Seattle Times editorial page editor, will moderate the president's panel. It includes Rodolfo Arruvalo, Eastern Washington, Mike Young, University of Washington, Elson Floyd, Washington State University, Bruce Shepard, Western Washington, Les Pierce, the Evergreen College, James Godino, Central Washington. Kate?
Let's start on the other side of the state. I've got a question for President Floyd from Washington State University. A recent report by the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education painted a grim picture of our state's ability to produce enough workers to meet the number of jobs expected in the next decade. The estimate is that 67% of the jobs in the state will require post-high school education, but only 40% of Washingtonians have a post-secondary education. Is there a way to make up this difference considering the state disinvestment in higher education that has occurred in the last 4 years and that is now threatened with the continuing budget crisis?
The conversation is indeed one about the future of our state and how does the state of Washington look in that context. And in response to your question specifically, Kate, it is important to note that we are a net importer of college graduates in our state. As we look across the nation, there are only two other states that will import more college graduates than the state of Washington does. We need to figure out an effective way to grow our own, to keep them here, to add to the economic growth and vitality of our state. There is no debate at all about the contributions that college graduates provide to the economy. The incarceration rates are lower, they pay higher taxes, they rely less on social and human services. So if we are to get out of this financial situation in which we find ourselves, we must have a highly educated workforce that will add to the economic growth and vitality of our state. The biggest challenge that we have as university presidents is to make sure that during this fiscal crisis, we preserve the quality and the excellence of the institutions that you've invested in, that we preserve the quality and excellence. And we will do everything within our power to do precisely that. But we do need the help of the legislature in that regard. Let me provide just a brief context associated with the other response to this question. If one were to go back to 1991, the state's overall budget was $15.9 billion. The share of that budget for the four-year sector was 9%, or $1.4 billion. Let's fast forward to 2011. The overall state budget has now grown to $32 billion. The percentage of the budget invested in higher education has now diminished to 3%, or $980 million. We are going in precisely the wrong direction. More about that later.
Thank you. President Peirce, let's take off where President Floyd left off with the change in the state budget over those years. During that time, the investment in public four-year institutions in real dollars is less now than it was 20 years ago. Meanwhile, the universities, all of you, are serving 32,000 more students. What do these numbers tell you about the degree to which it is a priority for the state to educate the next generation? And what is at risk if this trend does not stop?
What I was struck by when I read this report was the holistic look that it took at our overall educational system. What it identified was that at the K-12 level, the huge gap in the prospects of who might be able to come to college in the future to even get out of high school. And now the issue that Elson articulated that just simply has to do with the numbers of individuals that will not be coming to the doors that will have access to higher education. What does it say about our future? It says that we will continue likely to import individuals from out of our state to do the work that needs to be done for a growing industry, or it means that industry will make decisions to move to states where states make a commitment to higher education that recognizes the value of that for the future. it raises some profound issues for us about what our future brings. It raises the issues in regard to the demographics and who's coming through our K-12 system. And it speaks to the fact that unless we look at the whole continuity of the educational system in this state, from early learning all the way through our baccalaureate degrees, and we can't figure out a way to find the leadership to be able to bring those forces together to make sure that we can shore all of those up, that we face a real calamity, I think, in terms of our economics and the future of who has the opportunity to have the best jobs in this state. Do we want our citizens to be the ones that end up working for individuals that come prepared to this state to be the people that lead and direct? Or do we want a state that realizes the reality that we want to have the opportunity for all of our citizens to be prepared for the future and the demands of technology and education in all of its elements? That's what I think it means.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that effect on the ground for the students and the families that have to pay the rising tuition. President Gardino from Central Washington University, you have a huge number of your students are first generation attending college, is that correct?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the impact of escalating tuition has been on those students. Historically, the state has paid about 60% of the cost of educating each student, and with the rest being picked up by the students and their families. Today, it's I think that ratio is completely reversed, where the families are paying more than that, more the larger number. Isn't that really a tax on students?
Oh, of course it is. I mean, there's just no question about it. You know, it's very interesting. When I talk to students, they talk about their right to a college education. That's how they're seeing it, because they know that a college education is currently really the ticket to a middle-class life. You know, if we look at how the state's, at least my understanding of how the state's constitution was drafted, talking about education being a paramount duty, I suspect when it was drafted, that meant the sixth grade. We now take it as high school, but students now realize it's not high school. It's at least a technical or a community college degree, and more likely it's a bachelor's or beyond. So they're there, they're struggling, but it means really two things on the ground. It means that they're accumulating more debt. It really means three things, I think. They're accumulating more debt. They are working, many of them working 40 hours a week and going to school full time, which of course takes less time, less energy out of their day, so that they're not doing that on their studies. And then the third thing that we're seeing, and I think probably all of us are seeing, is a lot more stress and mental health problems. We're actually increasing the number of mental health counselors at our university because of the incredible pressure. And students are beginning to question whether or not leaving a university $20,000-$25,000 in debt, living that lifestyle, maybe taking 6 years to graduate now, lost opportunities of working in more of a blue-collar environment, one that they're really trying to avoid by getting a college education, whether it's worth it. So we're seeing students stopping out, and a lot of those students that stop out don't come back.
President Arevalo, I want to ask you a little bit more about that, because I know that your campus at Eastern Washington University has done a lot to reach out to first-generation college students as well, including members of minorities. What does the escalating tuition mean to those efforts?
Well, I mean, I think that it's going to be, obviously, as my colleagues have mentioned, increasingly more difficult for kids that are from underrepresented backgrounds to go to school because their parents see the minimal amount of dollars that they make and having to put up a greater share of that for tuition becomes very difficult. The fact of the matter, though, is that at the levels that we are now, it's significantly impacting middle-class students, not the poorest students. So it means that now it's even more difficult for a broader strata of families to want to become engaged and send their kids to college. I think from my perspective, one of the things that we try to do, obviously, is to try to encourage not only the student but the family, because I think the family and the student needs to be convinced that education is the road to improvement in terms of social and economic standing. And I think it's just, as Jim mentioned, more difficult for parents to see that is, in fact, a benefit. A lot of us spend a lot of time, I know that I do, going to high schools, and when I get an invitation from a principal or a superintendent to go, my immediate response is, I don't just want to talk to the students. If you're willing to arrange a meeting with your faculty and a meeting with parents, those are the three groups that I think need to understand why education is important.
President Young, in his State of the Union address last week, President Obama suggested that if universities and colleges continue to raise tuition, they will see their federal support go down. Could you talk about what your concern is and how federal money figures into the mix of running your university?
I could talk about it at great length. I very much appreciate the president's attention to the issue of rising tuition. I mean, that is a real concern, one that all of us share. I think the problem at the moment is they've got the guns trained on the wrong problem. At the end of the day, our costs over the last 20 years have, in real dollars, remained constant. In fact, it costs less to educate a student now at the University of Washington than it did 20 years ago. But as you described earlier, the payer mix has changed. 20 years ago, the state was paying 80% of the cost. Now it's 20%, and the student's paying 20%. Now students are paying 70% of that cost. But at the same time, our capacity to increase tuition has been essential to maintain quality as well as to provide opportunity. We have 30% of our entering class this year are first-generation students. We have 8,000 students who are still on the Husky Promise. In fact, we were able to give scholarship money to 2,000 more students because of that capacity to have some flexibility in tuition. So looking at a school like the University of Washington and looking only at tuition increases, while at the same time we have reduced costs, we have actually increased access, and in fact we have been able to give even more scholarship money to precisely the group of people that the administration claims it wants to move into the middle class, is the wrong target. And to meddle in that by threatening to cut scholarship funding or federal funding to precisely those schools that are doing this is just simply not the right policy. And to look at it in terms of percentage increases, when all of us have tuitions that are significantly below our peer institutions and dramatically below the private institutions, and to look only at percentage increases as the barometer of a school's inability to hold down cost, is just simply not congruent with reality. And that's the point. The idea of being concerned about tuition increases is something that we are passionate about and share warmly with the president. But if the federal government's going to get involved, it needs to get involved in a way that targets the real set of issues and provides real solutions.
What would be the top two ideas on that in terms of what can the federal government really do?
Well, the federal government can certainly increase Pell Grants. 30% plus of our students are on Pell Grants, and in fact, our university educates more Pell Grant recipients than the entire Ivy League combined. I mean, we are the ones educating America. Secondly, if they want to deal with state declines in funding, they can do the same thing with Medicaid, which is to attach federal dollars to matching state dollars in a significant way. Those are solutions that actually motivate the state to reinvest. And some states are doing that, unlike Washington. Right now, the average decline in state support for public education, higher education in the United States, is 4%. But as you heard earlier, Washington is close to 50%. We are competing with those states. And some federal stimulation to encourage and make available would be one possible solution. Not one I'm necessarily recommending, but if they want to move the needle, they've got to look at what the problem really is.
Okay, thank you. So President Shepherd from Western Washington University, as you look around the country, are there states that appear to be doing a better job keeping their investments in higher education at pace with their needs? their job markets, their needs for educated workers, and what edge, where does that put Washington in terms of competing with them?
Yes, there certainly are, as President Young has identified. Another way to look at it is that, as I look at the data, and there are good data out there, no state has found it necessary to slash public higher education to the extent that the state of Washington has. Other states have reinvested in higher education. I heard on the radio just earlier this week that Idaho has announced putting new dollars back into public higher education after having sustained the large slashes totaling 19% over the last few years. Again, the slashes here in Washington have been 50%. They're putting new money back. And I remind you that this isn't the Idaho that's known only for russet potatoes. Boise has boomed for decades based on its investments in high tech, and they understand this link between the well-being of the entire state and supporting public higher education. If I can add a personal note, I spent 30 years down in Oregon looking north at Washington, and I admired, contrary to what was happening in Oregon, what indeed I saw happening in Washington, where Washington simply seemed to get the fact that a state's wealth is best measured by the developed talent of its people. And I attributed this to the role of Boeing initially and later Microsoft and on. And my biggest shock when I got here 4 years ago, walking the halls of the Capitol, was that higher education was seen as the problem, not the solution. And frankly, I saw the private sector quiet while a target was being put on the back of public higher education. It is different down in Olympia today. I look forward to going to Olympia now. I didn't a couple of years ago. New leadership has stepped forward there who do get this link between the state's overall well-being. And it is leadership across the state. 4 years ago, I heard from legislators saying, we never hear anybody talking to us about higher education. They don't say that to me anymore, because parents, alumni, the good people and opinion leaders in this room are now taking charge, and that's where the leadership is coming from. So I am positive in the long run about how this could turn around for our state.
Okay, let's talk about something kind of specific. Many of you have talked about how you'd like more management flexibility in running your universities. I was wondering if we could just keep answers really short, but if each of you could just give me one example that would be helpful for you if you had more flexibility that would make it easier, educate more students, free up more dollars. Why don't we start with you, President Arevalo?
Well, I mean, I think there's a variety of things, but I mean, we could look very easily at something as simple as purchase agreements. Right now, the state only allows us to do one-year agreements. If we did multiple years, we could get more benefit, and we could get cheaper rates.
Okay. President Cardino?
I'll leave the big numbers to that end of the table, because that's where they all are. But I'll continue in the small ones. And this is, shows you the kind of handcuffs we have. This is a small dollar amount, but we're still required to have systems to issue paper payroll checks, even though very few people use them. A direct deposit, freeing us from that and having direct deposit, which most people use, would literally save us tens of thousands of dollars because we could eliminate that duplicative system.
President Floyd? Yeah,
Kate, there are any number of examples we could use, but let's just talk about salary increases right now. For the last 4 years, we've not had the ability as colleges and universities to provide any salary increases, with some few exceptions. But all of those exceptions have to be approved by Olympia. We've had circumstances in which our faculty and staff were desirous of meeting in large gatherings, conferences. There was a while in which we had to have all of those authorizations approved by Olympia. There is simply no way those of you in this audience could run your business with that level of micromanagement. We deal with it day in and day out. What we have to do is to make sure that we focus on the value-added proposition associated with higher education in our state, allowing our institutions to have the flexibility to invest those resources in areas that make eminently good sense. If I want to create a new IT system, Brett, at Washington State University, I have to get permission from Olympia, even if it's much more efficient relative to the services that we must deliver as an institution. Just an example. I must tell you, if I continue to go through this, all of you would would be a bit upset and appalled by it, and there is good reason for it. But these are our realities, and we've been asking the legislature for greater flexibility, not unbridled flexibility, however, because we understand the accountability piece. Let us report to the legislature at an agreed-upon time frame of what we've done with the resources that have been entrusted to us.
I just don't think... I think one of our biggest challenges, one of the biggest challenges we face, is that we just haven't caught up with the capabilities of technology. I mean, why is it that our institutions, our other state organizations, cannot utilize the new era of travel, access to purchase of tickets, the opportunities that emerge on a daily basis? We still are regulated in regard to the steps we have to take for access, for purchase, for travel. I think that what's capable now with technology, what we might be able to do with our systems could be freed up if we could review policies that are back in the 1960s and 70s that require old practices that have nothing to do with the era that we're in with technology and the digital world.
I think there are long lists that we have shared with our legislative colleagues and have taken very seriously in areas of purchasing and duplicative reporting and contracting. But rather than give you another example of one of those, I think I'd just like to take a minute or two to set the context. You're talking about six public institutions that 4 years ago were recognized as the most efficient in the nation. That's the point from which we start. Now, one of the principles of Lean, and we see it on our campuses, every time we go back to the well and look for new efficiencies, we find them, even though we think we're already as efficient as can possibly be. So we do continue to do that relentlessly. But the things we find we can save money on, the sorts of things you've heard my colleagues talk about, are saving tens of thousands of dollars when, the case of Western, we're seeing $30, $40, $50 million biannually being cut out of our budget. So we can't fool ourselves into thinking that efficiencies alone will allow us to sustain the quality that you expect from our universities, or more importantly, that are the answer to the crying demand out there for more baccalaureate-prepared Washingtonians.
What we're really asking for in this regard is just simply flexibility to manage our own affairs. As we do that, we already have squeezed out in the last about year and a half about $30 million out of our budget. And as Bruce suggested, every day we are doing more and more of that. We begin to run up against some walls that are regulatory or legislative in nature. And what we're just simply asking is the removal of those. It's not a magic bullet, but it has some it has an opportunity, as we're talking about the University of Washington, that money should go to students, not bureaucracy and administration. And that's what we want to do. As we look at that, there's another simple principle involved here, which is almost all the flexibility we're asking for really is flexibility that probably should be given to all state agencies as well. There's millions of dollars to be saved across government. This isn't just a set of issues unique to these six institutions, but many of the things we're asking for, really, we hope that we can demonstrate that these do have real cost savings in a way that is responsible, and we can demonstrate those savings, and then that can be scaled up and save the entire state government money as well.
Thank you. Someone earlier mentioned something about the limitations on salary increases, but I wanted to talk a little bit more about the brain drain. Are you finding that the budget crisis is making it difficult to attract and retain high-quality faculty? President Floyd, could you talk about that? WSU is a research university.
Sure. I'll be delighted to talk about that. You had posed a question early on about states that are continuing to invest in higher education. And we do have states across the nation that are investing in higher education. Believe it or not, West Virginia is one of those states. North Dakota, South Dakota is yet another. Texas is yet another. And we are competing each and every day with those institutions for the retention and the hiring of the best and brightest faculty members. What the public sometimes fail to understand is that if we have a star researcher who leaves the university because of the lack of an appropriate salary, she or he will take their research with them. Thus, the return on the investment that should redound to the benefit of the state of Washington will then go to the benefit of other states. But it's not only a national issue. It is increasingly an international issue. Australia, China, India, all are trying to build intellectual capacity, and they are doing it on the backs of our faculty because they are hiring them every day. And we have huge, huge limitations associated with trying to retain our best and brightest faculty members, you see. So this is a real crisis associated with our state and with our institution, but it also transcends to our students as well. I have said on any number of occasions that students will come to an institution based on the reputation of its faculty, and when those faculty members leave our institution, they will go elsewhere, thus the brain drain.
President Young, could you talk about the investment in research that the state is making, and how is that affecting your ability to sustain high-quality research programs?
Well, the state, generally speaking, doesn't make any investment in research. Mm-hmm. What the state does is historically, in the long-distant past at least, provided the core funding that allows you to engage the instructional mission. But as a research university, when you hire instructors, you're hiring researchers as well for two reasons. One is that is the way we teach. The research that goes on at the institution is part of the educational opportunity and process that we offer our students. And secondly, they do research that often translates into dramatic improvements in the quality of life, not only in Washington, but indeed throughout the world. Last year alone, the University of Washington secured about $1.5 billion worth of extramural research funding. I mean, and that in turn has an enormous short-term economic stimulation, not to mention the long-term economic stimulation, but that is a function of people. And if the professors are at risk, as Elson suggested, they take their research money with them, as well as the opportunities to commercialize that research, the opportunities to teach students through the process of generating that research. The research funding is usually from the federal government, from NIH, NSF, or foundations, and occasionally corporations as well. It doesn't come from the state, but the state has to provide the foundation that allows you to build the basic infrastructure of the institution that attracts that. And it is that core, that basic infrastructure, that really ends up at risk. And as that is at risk, you begin to lose the possibility of attracting that kind of professor and therefore that kind of research funding. Fortunately, at the University of Washington, we've been very lucky in our capacity to retain faculty, but it is at a point where the competition, not only among other states that are heavily investing increasingly again in higher education, but the private institutions. We compete with Harvard and Stanford and Yale. We attract professors away from there, and they go after our professors. And that has a significant impact on the opportunities for our young people, as well as the economic development of the state.
I would just add, from a public liberal arts point of view, in the 12 years that I've been at Evergreen, I have been amazed at the draw that we have for individuals that are interested in teaching. It's always been our strength and our mission. And people have been willing to come to the college because of the excitement of the curriculum and the opportunity to really be in the classroom. This year is the first year at a national meeting that I had the sense of potential faculty that are aware of the conditions in the state of Washington. And I fear that this spring, when we start our process, for the first time in our recruiting of the limited number of faculty we'll be pursuing, that it will be a bit more challenging. Last year, we lost National Science Foundation Teacher of the Year in public service. We couldn't even begin to get close to making an offer that would keep a person that has transformed one of our major science programs.
I'd like to add to that if I could, because sure. It's a challenge at an institution such as Western's as well. It was simple formula for the excellence at Western is outstanding faculty and staff with outstanding students. The biggest threat to our continuing to deliver for this state and serve the state with that degree of excellence is our ability to retain and attract outstanding faculty. Our reputation is based on faculty who came to Western 20, 25 years ago when Bellingham was a nice place to live, it was a good university, and it was an inexpensive place to live. Cost of living now in Bellingham is the same as Seattle. Our salaries are way below peers. We are seeing offers we can't begin to counter from other universities as around the country. Washington is now known as a place to go headhunting. And when it's time to attract faculty, they'll say, we'll come to Western because we really like the colleagues. We'll take a salary $5,000 to $8,000 below what we're being offered as new assistant professors. And then they look at the housing prices and they say, well, as nice as the communities are, we can't afford to live in Bellingham. We're commuting from Ferndale or Blaine. And so that's the real threat longer term to sustaining the excellence of our university.
And let me add one thing to that. There's a tipping point. The academy at writ large is a relatively small community. We all know each other. We all go to the same conferences together. We all read the same journals. Once the word gets out that Washington is not the place to go, professors, when they work with a doctoral student, will start to steer them away from Washington. So once that drain becomes significant and we tip it, it's going to take us decades to recover the loss that we will make. So, I mean, there's a kind of a cliche, it takes 5 years to ruin a university, but probably 30 years to rebuild it. And we're at that, I mean, we don't want to pass that tipping point. That's a real key element.
If I can add one other point on this, I really echo my colleague's sentiments on this. And I cannot tell you how proud I am of the University of Washington faculty who has soldiered through this, who have helped us find ways to find tremendous efficiencies, and despite this have been willing to stand up, take extra loads, to do a tremendous number of things to keep the quality and to keep the excellence of the educational experience and the research opportunities available. It's one of the reasons I was a little upset with the president. He insulted my faculty by that, and I didn't like that very much. At the end of the day, that goodwill on the part of these extraordinary people is something we need to maintain. We need to foster. We need to reward. Yeah. We need to keep them here. It's the six most extraordinary systems, institution of higher education in the nation, and we need to keep it that way, and that's the risk that we're under.
And understand that these individuals drive the economy. I mean, they are buying the houses. They are purchasing goods and services, and without them, our economy will continue to collapse. So now we understand better the lifespan associated with the economic recovery. And we need all of those component pieces to work. And we need state government to embrace where we are from the standpoint of the investment that must and should occur in higher education in our state. We are at a crisis and a tipping point.
And while faculty are obviously what we focus our attention on because they're the research engine and the teaching engine, staff as well. CFOs, enrollment managers, we're losing those people to other states as well, because most of those people deal in a national job, if not an international job market as well. So the brain drain will be beyond faculty. As it's already happening.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about the economic driver. Go to President Young again. A recent University of Washington economic report shows that for every dollar invested in the university, the university generates an additional $20 in economic activity statewide. Strikes me that more disinvestment would be working against the state's goals for economic recovery. Can you share some details about how investment in the universities create activity in the broader economy?
Well, absolutely. Most recent study we had done by outside consultants suggested for every dollar that the state invests in the University of Washington, we produce $22 worth of economic activity, which is over twice as much as the average flagship institution. It's usually about $10 of activity for every dollar. So that is extraordinary. It's $9.1 billion worth of annual economic activity. Indeed, for every tax dollar that goes into the university, our economic activity produces $1.47 of tax revenue. If they just keep my tax revenue, I'd be really happy. And so that's the kind of stimulation, 70,000 jobs. Probably 95% of these research fundings, this $1.5 billion, comes from outside the state. We get thousands of students who bring tuition dollars in order to study in these programs. We commercialize products and ideas and drugs and so forth that come from the university that create businesses here. It is an enormous economic engine, one of the largest employers in the state, despite a and that $5.5 billion worth of operating revenue is built on what is now less than $200 million of state investment. So it is an extraordinary return on that investment on the part of the state. And if that investment goes down, this ends up at risk.
Mm-hmm. President Gaudino.
The other thing is that beyond the economic impact that universities have, people don't understand that we also have a very large social impact. I can only imagine a number of things that we do. We do clinics for kids, low-income kids. We do clinics for the homeless in Spokane. We do clinics for vets, either in speech pathology, dental hygiene, physical therapy, and my colleagues here can give you a long list of other kinds of work that they do that, while it might not be economic, it certainly improves the social standing of people in our communities.
We're doing close to... we're doing close to $100 million of uncompensated charitable health care at the University of Washington as well.
President Gaudino, what does Central mean to Ellensburg and Kittitas County?
Wow. I mean, I know why most of you go to Ellensburg on your way to Spokane. but to those of us who live there, I mean, it's impossible to think about Ellensburg without Central Washington. It's equally, because of the size of the university and the size of the town, it's impossible to think of Central Washington University without Ellensburg. I mean, the two are so closely intertwined. And I'm going to answer that question. We're the largest employer by far in Kittitas County. If you add up the next four employers, they do not equal the payroll or the number of employees of Central Washington University. That's just discounting all the students, the tuition dollars, the research activities that go on at Central. There's something we haven't talked about, and I think we should. We've been framing this as we should in economic terms, because without question, higher education should be thought of as part of the infrastructure of the state. Just like we think of roads and electrical systems and computer systems, education is one of those infrastructures, and it fuels so much. But one of the reasons people come to Washington or stay in Washington is the quality of life that we have. Now, some of that is our beautiful surroundings, but some of that is the artistic environment that we enjoy. So, you know, I don't want to brag, but I will. Our music program, our undergraduate music program, by far the best in the state. We have the acoustical environment.
Those
in our
are building, fighting words. Those is, are fighting words.
Which is
goes there for your music.
Everybody goes to Central for the music. So when you when you stop at McDonald's, come on down because there's probably a performance.
That's right. There's a performance going on.
Yeah, there's a performance going on at Central. And occasionally Dr. Peirce will come over and sing for you as well. But one of the prime economies of Ellensburg and a lot of people in Kittitas Valley are people who move over there either as a primary, from the west side, as a primary home, a secondary home. If you ask them why they do that, well, part of it is the availability of land. They get horses. They do that kind of a Western lifestyle. But they'll say it's because Central Washington there, and there is theater that we bring. There is art that we bring. There are art galleries that we bring. There are musical performances that we bring. There's a diversity that Ellensburg has because of the students that we bring from around the world, around the country, and around Washington. We have to realize that One of the reasons companies come here and one of the reasons workers come here is the total social fabric. And universities are a large part of that social fabric. You begin to degradate the universities, we'll degradate the quality of life that Washington has.
Well said, John.
President Arevalo, the University of Pennsylvania report cites a lack of political commitment to implement a statewide higher education plan. It also suggests that the elimination of the Higher Education Coordinating Board might limit political leadership capacity. Could you talk about that change that's pending and what kind of leadership is needed to drive a vision forward?
Well, I mean, I think, and this is not to criticize the current board, but I think one of the things that we as a group have talked about is really looking at a higher education coordinating organization that allows and focuses on educational policy, the needs of the state, the ability to allow the six universities to assess the needs in their region and in the state and provide the appropriate response. Sometimes people think that the six of us don't talk. Well, we do. That's why, for example, Elson and I do a joint program in communications disorders. That's why in one of my degree programs, even though they're on the semester basis, we're on the quarter, we've changed to the semester for that particular degree so that we can collaborate. And I think those are the kinds of things that a coordinating board needs to do, is to really set a direction for where the higher education needs are of the state and then allow the universities to work together to achieve it.
President,
let me just make just one other observation. Our state has also made a significant investment in our branch campuses. The branch campuses are a fundamental part of what we do. Whether we're talking about Eastern or Central or Western, they also have presence outside of their main campuses as well. And all of us have attempted to align the academic programs associated with our regional engagement to fuel the economies in which we are part of. I will give you two very quick examples. One, in Spokane, with our branch campus there, we've aligned it with healthcare. And we're in collaboration with the University of Washington in that regard, an incredible partner, and we are delighted to have the University of Washington as a partner. And we will do everything that we can to fuel healthcare in Spokane. In the Tri-Cities, we're working on bioproducts and biofuels in partnership with PNNL in many instances. And in fact, with that organization, we've jointly hired faculty members. That's a huge return on the investment that you've made in WSU, but it's also a return on the investment that has been had by the federal government as well. And in Vancouver, it's about applied technology. We're not doing these things in a vacuum. We are doing them based on needs analysis, what the strengths of our campuses are, how we can position them with the communities in which we are part of. I also have a great privilege of having a presence in all counties here in our state through extension, because we are the state's only land-grant research institution. That's important. It is the alignment of academic programs and research offerings with the priorities of the communities in which we are part of. That's what drives the institution. That's what's going to drive the economy. And that's what's going to distinguish the state of Washington from other states.
I know that many of the universities have partnerships with community colleges, too, to help build capacity and serve the communities throughout the state. I know that that Washington ranks third from the bottom among states in per capita enrollment in four-year programs, and that's basically been flat in Washington State for some time. Nationally, it's growing. Why is that stalling, even with all of your innovative approaches, the branch campus expansions, the partnerships with community colleges? Why are we not moving that number? President Shepard?
I have decided I need to have somebody print up a button that I can start wearing that simply says, "It's the budget, stupid." It really is a case that before the latest round of cuts, this state ranked near the bottom in the baccalaureate capacity it chose to provide to its citizens. As has been noted, we're a net importer of education talent, and that sustained our economy. That has several dimensions that put our future at risk. It's not a sustainable strategy, and there's a fairness issue. What that really means is we've made the investments necessary to prepare our students adequately, to prepare our sons and daughters adequately to go to work for those who come from out of state to get the higher paying jobs. That's what we've done over a period of decades here in this state by ranking 48th out of 50 states in baccalaureate capacity. As we look to the future, it is not sustainable to continue to import talent because those numbers are weakening right now. It is no longer as easy to attract the kind of talent the state needs to flourish. So that's a real worry for our future. Again, I'm positive about people now getting that in the state and that we can turn this around. But if we don't, we're, instead of being a globally challenging state, we're waving a white flag. I know Washington won't do that.
I would just add that you know, in our relationship with the community colleges, we've had extraordinary growing relationship over the years, and the pressure of the budget and the resources are having a real impact on our ability to even sustain the 2+2 programs we've had in the past. Many of our institutions have their academic programs on campuses in partnership with the community colleges. The Evergreen State College has the largest number of direct transfers from the community college system in the state. Almost 50% of our students are transfers from the community college system. It's a powerful system around the state that complements us well. But Bruce said it's the budget, and I have to agree. For us to think that we can continue to think about how we strengthen those ties or have the relationships as we look at what our priorities have to be as we shrink, we're going the other way in those relationships. And what that means is this issue of us growing the number of Washingtonians that get a baccalaureate degree is going the other way as well. I think we have to be honest about that. That's one of many things that are occurring in a system that a decade ago was powerful and rich when I came here, that I loved about it. And it's one of the things in both of those structures that are at risk.
There is a continuum. It begins with early learning. It goes through K-12. For many students, the community college or two-year route is the route that they will choose into the four-year institutions. And we need to make sure that there is a quality measure associated with every step in that process. We also need to make sure that we are doing everything within our power to make it collaborative, to make it seamless, not placing barriers for students to transfer into our institutions, to have more what we refer to as articulation agreements, that is a definition around those courses that will transfer, not creating an environment in which we have to, as an institution, engage in remedial instruction. So it's all about the total system of education in our state that will serve as a defining measure. And that's why conversations about basic education and the cost associated with basic education and the cost associated with two-year institutions and four-year institutions is very dysfunctional unless we talk about it as part of a collective family.
And I would just add, it's wonderful to see this huge crowd and to think about what this means for our democracy. You know, oftentimes when we're facing the challenges that you've heard us talk a bit about tonight, with my staff, I'll stop and I'll say to them, wait a minute, these challenges are real, but we have it pretty nice in higher education. And I also always have to be mindful of that. And I know in our conversations together, we're mindful of the fact that, you know, we have communities, citizens that are hurting now. And part of our responsibility is to be able to figure out how to make sure that students can come to our institutions. And I think that's what you're hearing from us now. We recognize the fact that we have to be responsible in terms of being accountable. We also understand that everybody has to share in this challenge that we have in regard to the cuts that we face. But I think what you're hearing from us is we need to have equity now. The decisions that have been made in the past have not been equitable. And we're willing to respond to the accountability measures because we believe we should. But we also are enthusiastic and believe that in order for us to do the kind of effective job that we can do for students, we have to figure out how to turn around a direction that is just devastating for us.
Let me ask President Floyd, you know, we've talked a lot about the challenges, but what do you need from the public? What do you need from your students, your alumni, your community members, employers that are hiring your graduates? What do you need them to do?
We need our alumni and friends and supporters, all of whom, many of whom are in this audience today, to be very strong voices for higher education, to be very strong voices for education, to be very clear with our legislature that enough is enough, that higher education is willing to take its fair share of any budget reduction in response to this fiscal crisis, but it should not take a disproportionate share of the cuts, that we no longer can rely on tuition to fill the financial gap associated with the decline in state appropriations. That's the message. If there are two sentences that I could ask you to communicate to all of your legislators, that is, invest in higher education because it's important to the future of the state of Washington.
Thank you. So please join me in thanking the university presidents for their participation tonight.
Great job. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special presentation of Northwest Public Radio, The Six Presidents. Our thanks to the Seattle Times and Seattle Town Hall for making this happen and allowing us to be there. If you'd like to listen to this again, come to nwpr.org. I'm John Paxson, Northwest Public Radio.